A graduate of the Columbia University School of Journalism, Dave Lindorf is an award-winning investigative reporter who has been in the business for 33 years. He writes regularly for Counterpunch, Extra, Salon, Business Week, The Nation, and Treasury and Risk Management magazine, and has been a contributor to such other publications as Rolling Stone, Mother Jones, The Village Voice, and Forbes, among others. He is the author of 4 books, his most recent of which is The Case for Impeachment, Legal Arguments for Removing President George W. Bush from Office, which he co-authored with Barbara Olchansky, and which is the subject of today's conversation. Dave Lindorf, it's good to be able to talk with you.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So, Dave Lindorf, I wanted to start by asking you about your reasons for writing this book. What first made you think about writing the book, and why do you think the issue of impeachment is such a pressing one?
Actually, you know, it's kind of interesting. When I was actually approached to write this book by the publisher, St. Martin's Press, and when they asked me if I would do it, I thought it was kind of a wacky idea, because this was last October, and, you know, while I had seen when I would be at anti-war demonstrations in New York and Washington, these signs that would say impeach Cheney first or impeach the commander-in-chief or whatever people were having these signs, they tended to be sort of, you know, it just seemed like a wild idea, and it was almost done as a joke by people back then. And but I took the assignment in part because it had a good advance, and I thought it would be interesting. I mean, the topic was interesting, but I didn't take it very seriously until I started to work on it. And then two things happened. One was that it suddenly started to seem possible. By January, people were talking about the House being taken over by the Democrats, the House of Representatives, which is where impeachment has to begin. And you know, if that happened, suddenly impeachment is a possibility. Right? It's an impossibility as long as the Republicans control Congress. So suddenly,
could you just explain the process of impeachment before you?
Yeah, I mean, the Constitution lays out very clearly that impeachment, except for an arcane method that some people are attempting now, that you could get a state, both houses of a state legislature to vote for a bill of impeachment. That's a unusual way to try to impeach a president, but the way that's laid out in the Congress, in the Constitution rather, is that a member can submit a bill of impeachment, and it then goes to the Judiciary Committee, which has to hold hearings on that bill. Of course, if the Judiciary Committee is controlled by the president's party, which is the case right now, they'll figure out a way to block it from going anywhere. But if the Democrats, as the opposition party, were in control of the Judiciary Committee, which would happen if the Democrats take over a majority position in the House in November, then the Judiciary Committee, which would be headed by a congressman named John Conyers from Michigan, your next-door neighbor, would be very favorable to hearings, would probably hold hearings, would have the power to subpoena witnesses and force them to testify under oath. And this is what happened with the Clinton impeachment, and more importantly, with the Nixon impeachment. And it's where, in the Nixon impeachment, we had people like John Dean, the president's legal counsel, and his chief of staff, Bob Haldeman, and, you know, others, the head of the FBI, L. Patrick Gray, started to tell the truth under oath because they didn't want to get caught in a lie and go to jail. And that's where the real evidence of Nixon's crimes came to light, and it's where I suspect Bush's crimes would really come to light. So, and one thing that happened was that as I started to write the book, I realized this could really happen, which made me much more you know, aggressive about working on the book. And then the second thing that happened was that as I was writing it, it was conceived originally as a fairly short little book, you know, maybe 60,000 words. But as I was writing it, I kept having to go back to the publisher and say, listen, I have to add another chapter because Bush's crimes kept mounting. You know, we had the expose about the NSA spying came out in December, 1 month into my research on the book, and then We had the signing statements, you know, where the president signs bills into law and then adds a little appendix letter called a signing statement in which he says he's not really going to follow the law, which is just astonishing. It's a total shredding of the Constitution. So we had to add quite a bit to the book, and it turned into a significant volume by the time we were done. So that's the genesis of the book. It became what I think is a serious, a truly serious enterprise at laying out the quite extensive crimes against the Constitution of this president.
So you mentioned that impeachment is a real possibility, but Nancy Pelosi, the House Minority Leader, has said that impeachment's off the table. And even you've written in the preface to your book that little action can be expected from the Democrats because of their timidity and complicity in the crimes.
Yeah, that's true.
Of George Bush. And you've actually excoriated the Democrats for their inability to have any political will on this. Do you think that the political will is there?
Well, it's not going to come from the Democratic leadership. It's going to come from the American people if there's going to be an impeachment. This is a really fascinating impeachment issue this time around, because if you look at the three times there's been a serious attempt to impeach a president in history. One was Andrew Johnson right after President Lincoln was assassinated. One was, of course, Richard Nixon in the 70s, and the other was Bill Clinton. In all three of those cases, the impeachment effort began in the Congress and was initiated by the president's opponents, political opponents in the Congress. And the public, in all three of those cases, did not support impeachment when the Congress began the effort to impeach the president. And in Johnson's case, it's not clear that the public ever supported impeachment. It's in Clinton's case, it's clear that the public never supported impeachment. The support for impeachment never rose above 36% in the entire process of Clinton's impeachment. And in Nixon's case, what happened was when the impeachment effort began, when the hearings started, the support for impeachment was way down in the 20s. But as the hearings progressed and as the nature of Nixon's crimes came to light, and ultimately with his the discovery of his tapings of conversations in his office in which he confessed really to his crimes, the public support for impeachment soared, and in the end his own party cast him overboard, and that's why he resigned. He was told he would lose office and be thrown out and also probably be indicted unless he resigned, which is what he did. I believe that we're in a unique situation this time in which the opposition party has been so intimidated and so compromised over the last 5 years that, especially the last 4 years, that they don't even know how to be an opposition party, but that the public is behind impeachment. The polls show that over 50% of the American public favors impeachment on several issues: the war, the NSA spying, and probably some other categories that haven't really been polled, like the signing statements. And 80% of Democrats favor impeachment. So, you know, if you were an intelligent Democratic leader, you'd probably say, God, if we want to rally our troops, we should be calling for impeachment in November. And instead what they do, the Democrats are so pathetic, the leadership, that what they say is, if we call for impeachment in the election campaign, we might energize the Republicans. And this is the last thing Democratic leaders want to do is rally and energize their own base. I think they're kind of afraid of where their base would take them if they energized them. But that is what's needed. And part of the purpose of our book is to energize that base and to get people to demand that their elected representatives take a stand on this. Because the other argument about impeachment is that the crimes are so serious you can't do strategic discussions about what's best for the party and best for the election in November. You have to say this president has committed grave crimes that threaten actually democratic governance in the U.S., and he has to be impeached.
Mm-hmm. Is the question of impeachment a question of looking at one or two specific high crimes and misdemeanors, such as the carrying out of the Iraq War, lying to the population of the population and to Congress about the necessity for war, and like you've mentioned, the NSA spying and the signing statements? Is it a question of looking at one or two of these things and saying this is what we need to impeach him for, or is it an accumulation of all these crimes that is going to be the grounds for impeachment?
Well, our feeling is that on any one of the ones we raised, he should be impeached. They're all so serious that any one of them would be grounds for throwing him out. And we can run down the list of some of these. They're quite astonishing crimes, but with grave, you know, implications if they're not. If they're not challenged. But the typical approach, I think, if you look back at impeachments, is to lay them all out and then take votes. Because one of the things that Barbara did, and Barbara's role in this book was the constitutional scholar. I mean, she's a brilliant constitutional lawyer who has been handling the lead role in organizing the defense of 300 of the Guantanamo detainees and also some of the rendition cases, including the one from your country. So she knows the Constitution backwards and forwards. And the thing that she makes clear in the book that we actually, neither of us really realized when we started the book, is that impeachment is really not about whether the president broke a law or not. It's really about crimes against the republic, crimes, the term high crimes and misdemeanors, particularly the term high crimes, meant political crimes. And when you read the discussions of the Founding Fathers, that's made very clear. They were talking about crimes that are political crimes against the people, the Constitution, the country's survival. And so things like, you can see it in the impeachment of Nixon, where he was accused in one of the articles that was voted out of the Judiciary Committee of lying to the American people. That's not a law that was broken. That is a, you know, whatever you call it, a compact with the American people to you know, honestly serve the people, and he lied. And so, you know, then you have to look and say, well, every politician lies, we know that, probably every one of yours lie too. Mm-hmm. but what's the consequence of the lie? Is the lie about whether you had sex with a intern, or is the lie something that put the country into a war, killed 100,000 plus innocent people, and 2,500 of your own young men and women? That's a serious lie, and it's a lie that should require that a president be thrown out of office, even though you couldn't put him into jail for it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get into the specific arguments for impeachment. And I'd like to start with the Iraq War, which we've just been talking about. And you mentioned Congressman John Conyers, who submitted over 540,000 signatures requesting answers to questions raised by the Downing Street memo. Could you give us a thumbnail sketch of the Downing Street memo and maybe explain the significance of Congressman Conyers' actions, particularly since he is going to be the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee?
If the House is taken over by Democrats.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So. Well, the Downing Street memo was a memo that was written by the, it was authored by the head of the British intelligence, MI6, and he had come to the U.S. Just before the Iraq, or not before the Iraq War, about, 2002, I'm trying to remember the date. It was like early summer of 2002, and he met with the key people in the United States, because Britain is, you know, as you know, the number one ally of the U.S., and in the Iraq War, it was seen as an essential part of, you know, pretending we had a coalition that was going to do this. And so Britain was the key figure that the U.S. was going to pull along. Mm-hmm. He came back and reported to Blair that after meeting for hours with George Tenet, the CIA chief, and other key White House people, his conclusion was that the U.S. was going to go to war and they were going to manipulate the intelligence. He used the term fix the intelligence to support the cause of going to war. At the time, the public position of the administration to the American people and to the world was that the U.S. did not want war and was trying to pressure Saddam Hussein to clean up his act, let in inspectors, and of course he was letting in inspectors. But the plan, it made it clear that even in the case of inspectors, they were going to try to entrap Saddam Hussein into throwing out the inspectors so they could then have a cause to go in. So the Downing Street memo was all about how the U.S. was going to go to war, come hell or high water, against Iraq. And the reason it became a big issue was that the British papers reported on it. I don't know about the Canadian papers. The British papers reported on it when it was first leaked, but the U.S. media didn't report on it. And so there was a huge internet campaign spearheaded by a guy named David Swanson, which forced the media to admit that in the U.S. that this document existed and was raised serious issues. But that's almost a secondary element in the war, because there's two issues with the war. First of all, the U.S. going to war against Iraq was in itself the number one war crime that can be committed. If you go to war against a country which poses no immediate threat, that is by definition under the Nuremberg Charter, which the U.S. is a signatory to and an author of. That is called a crime against peace, and it's the number one war crime. So right there, that we consider that to be like the number one impeachable offense. He should be locked up, maybe executed for that crime. The law was actually written to respond to Tojo and Hitler. And we know what happened to them. I mean, Hitler would have been executed. So that's the number one war crime. Of course, it's a war crime that almost certainly wouldn't be voted as an impeachment article, because countries never impeach their leaders, attack their own leaders as war criminals. But we felt it's important to lay it out since it's so serious. There are other war crimes, torture and rendition issues, which Barbara's so deeply involved in, are all like huge violations of the Geneva Convention, and all warrant serious punishment for those leaders who do them. And Bush is up to his eyeballs in that. So, again, war crimes. But although we laid them out, we aren't under the illusion that he'll ever be impeached for them. What's to be hoped, I guess, is that after he's no longer in office, that some country that has world jurisdiction in its laws, like Germany, I don't know if Canada does, Germany and France do, and Spain, is that Bush would be arrested if he traveled into those countries and would be brought up on charges of war crimes, him and his officials. But that would take a country with a lot of guts. So that's the war crimes issue. We feel actually that the most impeachable issue, and probably the most serious, aside from the war crimes from a U.S. perspective, is the signing statements. Because if you allow a president to totally trash laws passed by Congress, when Congress, the Constitution clearly laid out in our system of government a tripartite power structure aimed at protecting against usurpation of power primarily by a president. That's what the Founding Fathers were most afraid of, was that a president could become a dictator. So they said that all legislative power, it's very clear in the Constitution, all legislative power resides with the legislature. And the president is saying, no, it resides with me because in wartime I'm the commander-in-chief. And so I get to be the legislature and the judiciary and the president. So it's by definition, he's saying that he misconstrues the term commander-in-chief, which in the Constitution was laid out very specifically to ensure that a civilian would be in charge of the military, because what they were afraid of was that you could have a military takeover in the U.S., and so they wanted to say that all the generals have to bow down to the president, who has the top rank in the military as commander-in-chief. The president and his lawyers have construed it as more of what we in common parlance would refer to as a generalissimo. So he sort of sees himself more in the role of Mussolini, and that's how he's using the term commander-in-chief. So he really is calling himself generalissimo, and I make all the rules. And that simply doesn't fly, particularly because there is no war. You know, we're not at war in Iraq. That's a occupation and police action that's being done at the behest of supposedly, you know, under law, a sovereign government, which is the Iraqi government. So the U.S. is not at war. And we're certainly not at war in Afghanistan, where the war was declared over back in October 2002. What we are there is part of a U.N. action under law and a guest of the government of Karzai there. So where are we at war? We're at war in the war on terror, which is not a war. And so the president is using this fake war called the war on terror. We've had a war on poverty and war on drugs. You know, now we have a war on terror, and all of them are equally not wars. But he's using that term to try to claim a dictatorship, the power of a dictator. And so if he's not stopped on that, then every president becomes a dictator afterwards. And that's why we think it's the most impeachable argument. Even conservatives, when you point this out to them, start to get alarmed.
So you've basically outlined three arguments for war: policies of torture, through the
crime against peace,
the crime against peace through the Nuremberg Tribunal, and the signing statements and the abuses of power.
Yeah, there's a lot more, though. I mean, we have whole other chapters on other issues. I mean, some of them are quite specific. Like we have a chapter on the Valerie Plame case,
mm-hmm.
and there's a case where, you know, I don't think the outing of the CIA agent is the issue. The outing of the CIA agent is a small part of what that case is really about. And some people on the left, and I'm inclined this way, would argue that the outing of a CIA agent is actually a good thing because it has validated what people on the left and journalists, progressive journalists, have for years tried to out agents, and the government's tried to make it a crime to do so. And now Bush's White House has essentially said, no, it's okay, you can do that. But what's behind the Valerie Plame thing is, why did they do it? And the reason they did it is because her husband was basically
Joe Wilson.
Joe Wilson was actually exposing what increasingly appears to have been a black operation by this very subversive and treasonous operation that was run out of Rumsfeld's Pentagon, the Office of Special Plans, which, you know, with people like Michael Ledeen and Hadley and, you know, others whose records go back all the way to the old Iran-Contra scandal that, you know, led to convictions of Oliver North and Poindexter and McFarland and stuff, that it's pretty clear now from the reporting done especially by reporters at La Repubblica in Italy that these people in the Office of Special Plans, together with some outside contract people, actually conspired to create false evidence of a purchase of uranium ore from Niger by Iraq, which never happened. They stole documents or bought stolen documents from the Niger embassy in Rome. They forged stamps on them to make it look like these purchases had occurred, but they did such a bad job that they used the signature of an official who hadn't been in office for 10 years. And, you know, any high school kid doing a report on Niger would have discovered that by, you know, Googling the CIA country reports that are, you know, available online about each country and see who's in office, you know. but this was clearly done to create a fake, you know, it was domestic propaganda, to a disinformation campaign to create false evidence and scare the hell out of the American people and the Congress so that they would agree to go to war. And that's why they attacked Wilson so viciously through his wife, was to prevent a real investigation into what that story was all about. And when that crime gets investigated, you know, that's a major issue. So that's one. That could bring the president down. Another one, and the vice president, by the way, who was central to that. Mm-hmm. Another one that we highlight is the attack on domestic civil liberties at home. I mean, this one of the things this president has done, and this has also alienated a lot of people on the right, as they've started to realize it, is this president has asserted that as commander in chief, he has the powers to override not only all the articles in the Bill of Rights, but also the habeas corpus provision that dates back in British common law back to, you know, the 1200s, that he can strip an American citizen of all their rights, of their citizenship, and make them by calling them an enemy combatant. They no longer are Americans. They are enemy combatants and can be thrown into a military prison, you know, sent to Guantanamo, whatever, renditioned anywhere at the president's will, killed at the president's will without a trial, held without charge, not allowed to see family or lawyer, or to know why they're being held, anything. And he's actually done this in a few cases we know about, like Jose Padilla and Mr. Hamdi and a few others. Those are the ones we know about. But Barbara makes the point that we don't even know how many other people this has been done to. American citizens. These are all American citizens. Mm-hmm. I would add native-born American citizens. So the president, in claiming that, has overstepped so many bounds. I mean, that's what we fought our revolution over, was you know, these rights that are enshrined in the Bill of Rights and in traditional British common law that the British colonial powers were ignoring. So, you know, that's a major impeachable crime. And then another area we went into, which is kind of making new law, but we think is really important, and that's the area of criminal negligence, because the founding father said you can't impeach a president for incompetence. Washington had proposed that they include incompetence, but the majority of the Constitutional Convention argued against that. So, but we feel that, I mean, if you could impeach for incompetence, Bush would be long gone. He's the most incompetent president we've ever had, I think, arguably at least. Certainly the consequences of his incompetence outstrip anything any incompetent president has done before. But what we feel is that, and there are constitutional lawyers who agree with us, like Elizabeth Holtzman, who was on the Nixon impeachment panel, we feel that incompetence can be so grotesque as to rise to the level of criminal negligence and then becomes a crime. And the examples of that we followed Liz Holtzman's lead in mentioning two things that she felt illustrated this, one being the failure to provide American troops with adequate body armor before sending them into Iraq, because the armor was available, it just needed time to be produced and distributed. And since he chose the timing of the war and could have waited till they were ready, that was criminal negligence to put them in harm's way when they didn't have to be. Similarly, and maybe more seriously, She argued, and we agree, that since the U.S. knew it was going to win in Iraq, and it was just a question of whether it would win in 2 weeks or 4 weeks, there was an obligation on the part of the commander-in-chief and his staff to develop a plan for occupation and how you would handle the country once you won. And they admit themselves that they didn't even bother to do that. So that was criminal negligence. And then we added two others, one being the non-response, just blatant non-response to the Katrina disaster as it became evident it was going to happen, and as it happened, as it unfolded, the president just ignored it and undoubtedly caused the death of hundreds and maybe more than 1,000 people whose deaths could have been avoided with the proper response. And finally, we feel that this president's willful ignoring and interference and actual overt obstruction of efforts by the various states and by foreign governments to respond to global warming crisis is the ultimate example of criminal negligence, and probably in the long term with the most far-reaching horrible consequences. He's wasted five years of a very narrow window to try to respond to that crisis. So we charge him with criminal negligence there too.
And what do you think of his policy alternatives? You know, ethanol, clean burning coal. You know,
well, it's all a crock, and scientists will all agree on that. I mean, there has to be a reduction in emissions of hydrocarbons, and ethanol doesn't do that. It just substitutes. First of all, it substitutes on a one-for-one basis the carbon emissions that that petroleum use in cars emit, and secondly, it actually takes almost as much energy to produce the ethanol from the corn as you are saving in the oil that that replaces. It's a joke, and not only that, but you know, any global climate scientist will tell you that the clearing of land for the substitution of crops that produce the ethanol is stripping the earth of the important area. A lot of this is going to come from Brazil, you know, from rainforest. And so what you're really doing is you're removing these lungs of the earth that are pulling in the building up carbon dioxide, and you're replacing it with crops that aren't going to do the job. So it's a bogus solution. It's really more aimed at trying to relieve some of the imports of oil to the U.S., but without changing consumption patterns. And coal would be a backward step, and his administration's talking about coal. None of his proposed solutions actually deal with it at all, and it's well known that, you know, these market solutions that he proposes are to pretend to be doing something where they actually are doing zip.
And the same goes with hydrogen.
Yeah, of course, because you have to use electricity there's various ways to make it. You can either be breaking up water, which requires energy from power plants, or you have to use methods of breaking. I think they use natural gas that they break the hydrogen out of, and that's, you know, that cracking mechanism requires huge amounts of energy. So it makes sense because you can remove pollution from the cities. So as a smog reducer or something like that, it can make sense. But it's not a solution in terms of the amount of carbon that's ultimately being put into the atmosphere, and that's the crisis.
Right.
Is how much carbon. So. And all of it becomes a joke because unless you really deal with it, you know, as you know, all those peat bogs up in northern Canada are going to be releasing, once the permafrost melts, they're going to be releasing, you know, 10 times the quantity of carbon into the atmosphere as they start to smolder and things that our cars are emitting. So we have a major crisis, and what does the president do? But actually uses trade measures to bully countries into not taking steps that could respond to global warming, and you know, in every possible way, he's interfered with efforts, the international efforts. They've blocked international conferences from accomplishing anything. It's just an obstructionist role down the line.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's get back to impeachment. Dave Lindorf, one of the things that you've written about is the black boxes that have mysteriously disappeared during the 9/11 recovery, site recovery. Could you maybe talk a little about that and how the criminal negligence with regard to knowing about the terrorist attacks and not doing anything, how does this indict incriminate George W. Bush?
Well, this is an interesting story. We actually went further than criminal negligence. We actually equated the administration's handling of 9/11 borders on treason, which is another ground for impeachment besides high crimes and misdemeanors. And the reason for that is that what this administration did, and there are plenty of people who've testified to this, including Bob Graham, who was the senator in 2002 who was heading the Intelligence Committee until he resigned at the end of that term. He has said that if he were now in the House, he would file an impeachment article specifically for the president's obstructing the and lying about the investigation into 9/11. This president willfully, his administration willfully barred important information from being released to both Senate and House Intelligence Committee investigators and to the Bipartisan 9/11 Commission, the formation of which they opposed, actually, even. And when Bush finally did go in to testify before that commission, his stipulations were that, first of all, he wouldn't testify to the full commission, only to a handpicked couple of members of that commission. He said there could be no cameras, no tape recorders, and no notes taken. And he would not be sworn and put under oath, and he had to have his vice president there holding his hand. So, you know, all of that clearly bespoke someone who wasn't planning on telling the truth. And so, you know, we know that this president lied and lied and lied about 9/11. We know that they used 9/11 the way the Nazis used the Reichstag fire, to scare the hell out of the American people and then grab power based on the fears that they manufactured about 9/11. They claimed that the U.S. was had its existence threatened by 9/11, which wasn't true, and you know, tried to get people to think that everyone was a terrorist and ran them, and they needed to have, you know, plastic and duct tape to make safe rooms in their houses. It was just incredible, the scaremongering that went on out of this administration. But our argument is that their obstructionism of the investigation and of efforts to find out what they knew ahead of time were, you know, at least border on treason and maybe are treason. But the interesting thing that I wanted to mention is that's one of our grounds for impeachment. But when we wrote that chapter, it was the one chapter where I ran into serious problems with the editors at St. Martin's, because I included the information that I had uncovered about the existence of the black boxes from the World Trade Center, because those were found, and I had a source at the National Transportation Administration and Safety Administration, who, you know, are the ones who investigate those boxes and get them to work, who said that we had the boxes and the FBI has them now, but I can't, you know, tell you that on the record. And so I had written an article about that, and I wanted to include it in the chapter, and some other things also, like the, you know, the investment bank that was never called in and asked about the puts that it put on four companies that they knew apparently were going to drastically lose stock value because of the attacks on the World Trade Center. That was Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, which had big offices in the Trade Center, and United and American Airlines, which were going to be hijacked. The investment bank that made those puts was called Alex Brown current now it's been bought by Deutsche Bank, but Alex Brown was headed until 1998 by a man who moved over to become the number three person in the CIA. So there was a very close connection between the people at Alex Brown and the CIA, and there they do this bizarre, you know, 1 week ahead of 9/11, they do these puts for clients who made a killing on, literally, on betting that those companies would all, you know, massively lose their stock value. And that those companies were never, or that company was never called in by the 9/11 Commission and asked, you know, well, who were the clients and how did you know to make those bets? You know, this is unbelievable that nobody's investigated this. But, you know, I was told by the editors, well, you can't include anything like that that suggests conspiracy of 9/11. And I said, why not? And they said, well, it isn't that we don't think that you have good facts here. It's that, you know, you will damage the credibility of the book because people will label it as, you know, tinfoil-hatted conspiracy theory. And so, you know, there are certain things that in the United States you can't do, and that's one of them. You know, one is to run for office if you don't go to church, and the other is to, you know, question whether there was a conspiracy for 9/11. I don't tend to be a conspiracy theorist, but I thought that these are questions that need to be asked, and that's all I wanted to say in the chapter. But my editor at the time, Sean Desmond, said, well, you know, when you're out on the promotion tours and people ask you about this, you can blame it all on me and give them my card, and, you know, they can call me and harangue me about it. But, you know, they told me that was a do-or-die issue on the book. If I insisted on it, they wouldn't publish the book, and I thought it was more important to publish the book, and then I'll tell people about the how it was blocked from being in the book, which I'm telling you. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, the boxes were found, and the official claim is they don't exist, which is ludicrous. You know, the boxes are indestructible. They're made to be indestructible. And so they don't always work after a crash, but they do exist. And, you know, they sifted through the World Trade Center stuff looking for little tiny pieces of bone, for God's sakes. And so it's not surprising that people found those boxes. I have backup for that because I know a young cop who spent 3 months working in the rubble, and he said he saw someone finding them, and he said he saw the federal agents take them off, you know, cart them off. So, you know, he knows they exist, and plenty of people know they exist, but the official position of the U.S. government is that the four boxes, the two, you know, cockpit tape recorders and the two data recorders for those two planes never were found.
We've been talking with Dave Lindorf. Dave Lindorf is a graduate of the Columbia University School of Journalism, an award-winning investigative reporter who's been working in the business for 33 years. His most recent book is The Case for Impeachment, Legal Arguments for Removing President George W. Bush from Office, which he co-wrote with Barbara Olshansky, and which we've been talking with him about today. A question I'd like to ask you is it enough to impeach the president? You've mentioned that Dick Cheney should be impeached, and other members of the cabinet, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, Donald Rumsfeld, all of whom are at least complicit in fabricating intelligence and initiating the war in Iraq, should they also be held to account?
Yeah, but our feeling is you don't change anything by impeaching the president in if you narrowly construe it as, you know, you get rid of him. You know, the first thing people ask is, well, don't we get Cheney then? But we feel that, you know, first of all, you have to impeach the president because he is a criminal. Second of all, in impeaching the president, the reason you impeach a president is because the president is immune from being indicted while in office, but none of those other officers are. So it's our sense that if you have genuine hearings on impeachment into the president's crimes, the vice president's crimes will be exposed at the same time, and he'll be indicted. You know, if someone like Patrick Fitzgerald has the authority to indict the vice president, as the evidence is is revealed. So, and we think also, if you want to just think realpolitik, I don't think the ruling elite in the United States, the corporate leaders who, you know, behind the scenes kind of manipulate where things go, if you want to take a conspiratorial view, these people don't want to see, and the Republican Party leadership would not want to see Cheney as president leading into the 2008 elections. He's not going to run for president. He's a singularly unpopular and repugnant individual who only has a popularity rating of something like 18% now. So, you know, nobody's going to want to be saddled with him going into 2008 in the Republican Party. So I think they'd figure a way to ease him out. He'd either resign because of his health. I mean, he's basically a robot anyway with, a heart that's pumped electronically. So... I don't think there's any reasonable way that you would see Bush replaced by Cheney. And so that would mean, you know, following our chain of events in which you'd have to have a Democratic Congress or House before you could have impeachment, the next person in line would be Nancy Pelosi, which may be one reason she's so coy about impeachment, is she may feel that it would be unseemly for her to be calling for impeachment when she's the likely beneficiary. but, you know, the in terms of getting rid of these people, I think a lot of them are going to end up going down through indictments because of their crimes. A lot of them are blatant criminals themselves. But if they don't, the process of impeachment is an empowering process all by itself. What it does is it rouses the American people from their slumber, their political somnolence, and causes them to face some of these big issues because they will be presented to them in, you know, boldly on television through the impeachment hearings, and which are great theater. And I think at that point people will abandon this cabal of criminals and power mad bureaucrats.
Mm-hmm. Well, you say that it's going to wake up the American population and it's going to provide great theater. Do you worry that the impeachment proceedings are going to completely overwhelm the political life of the United States and make it impossible for anything else to get done? I mean, that happened during Clinton's impeachment.
Well, that's probably a good thing. I mean, a lot of people say that, you know, keeping Congress tied up is the best thing you could do. I mean, that all it ever does is bad stuff anyway.
Really?
I'm being facetious, but certainly this Congress, the less it does, the better. But the bigger point, I think, is that impeachment, you know, you hear these pundits and Democratic Party leaders talking about, you know, we need to seriously do the business, people's business. You know, we don't want to get bogged down with impeachment. Impeachment is built right into this system of government. If you look at it in the Constitution, it's included right in the article defining the president's powers. I think the founding fathers conceived of impeachment as not being an unusual event, but something that would happen fairly often. You know, it sort of makes us more of a parliamentary democracy if we can get rid of a guy in midterm instead of having to wait the 4 years if he's overstepped the bounds. It doesn't interfere with the process of government. It is the process of government. So, I mean, I just think it has to be reviewed in a different way. People need to start to realize that this is a step that the founders conceived of as the appropriate thing to do when someone oversteps the limits of their power. So you know, it's not an issue of whether it interferes with other things.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking with Dave Lindorf, who is the author of The Case for Impeachment, Legal Arguments for Removing President George W. Bush from Office, which he co-wrote with Barbara Olchansky. And he's also a contributor to such great publications as Counterpunch, Extra, Salon, Business Week, The Nation, and Treasury and Risk Management Magazine. Dave, how can people get in touch with you?
The best way is to go to my website. You know, that's one way to see the work I'm doing and updating this story and other stories. And the other is if someone wants to write me, my email address is dlindorf@yahoo.com. In terms of getting the book, the best way to get it is to go to my website where they can read reviews about it. And also, there's a page of excerpts from all the chapters and links to, you can buy it at Amazon through those links or Barnes & Noble or, if you like unionized bookstores, Powell's Books.
Great. Dave, I wanted to ask you about the media coverage of your book. What kind of reception have you gotten within the media?
Oh, that's interesting. I just learned, to my great pleasure, that the book has sold a net 31,500 copies. That's after, the bookstores have returned copies that hadn't sold. So that's a really good initial run for a hardcover book, especially because no mainstream newspaper or magazine has reviewed it. It's completely blacked out as far as the mainstream media goes. It's also interestingly been ignored by the main alternative media. There's no review planned at Salon Magazine in these times.
Which you write for.
The Nation. All of these I write for. The Nation. They have no plans to review it, which is just, phenomenal. I think the sort of liberal democratic left is nervous about impeachment, so they're ignoring it. And the mainstream media doesn't want to touch it. And yet, it sold 31,000 copies without any, basically without any kind of advertising or promotion. So that tells me that there's, a huge sentiment for impeachment out there. The mainstream media is just, a bad joke. And the left media is not much better. Even Democracy Now, on Pacifica has not had us on.
Have you, you requested it?
Yeah, repeatedly, and they keep saying, "Well, not now,"
So where do you get your news from?
I get it from Democracy Now.
Okay.
Great outfit.
Okay.
I don't boycott her. She boycotts me.
Oh, okay.
I think she does a good job. I think she really should have, she should be bigger than that. Mm-hmm. She should be willing to say that, this is an important issue, an important book, and, mm-hmm. Have us talk about it. But they actually, they have Barbara on all the time because she's a spokesperson for the Guantanamo issue.
Right.
CCR. And the last time they said she called up and said she wanted to be on, and they said that she could talk about Guantanamo, but they weren't going to talk about the book.
It's tough love, man. It's tough love.
Yeah, exactly. So, things aren't all good on the left either.
And do you waste your time with the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, kind of the mainstream press?
Reading them?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah?
You have to read them. And in fact, I would disagree with you that it's not wasting your
time.
Particularly, it's not wasting your time to read the Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
The editorial pages are a joke, but... who was it who said that the Wall Street Journal famously is a publication whose editors never read their own news? half of the people that work for the Wall Street Journal are leftists on the reporting staff. You tend to gravitate there if you're a leftist journalist because the business people want the honest news. They need to make investment decisions not based on ideology, but on what's really happening. So if you want to know, there's a wonderful piece in the Friday Wall Street Journal that exposes the fact that, you should get this, it exposes the fact that that at the same time that workers' pensions are being gutted and canceled, at major Fortune 500 companies, the top executive pensions are ripping off the pension system, including their workers. And they had to have a real interesting article about how so severely that, you know, in some of the bigger companies, they're basically stealing like as much as $1 billion out of the pension pool that that belongs to their workers, and that's in the Wall Street Journal.
Wow.
I mean, it's a great publication. It's just stupid editorial.
Right. Well, they villainize Venezuela pretty seriously. I mean, it's constantly anti-Chavez rhetoric.
Yeah, but draw a distinction between the reporting and the editorials. I mean, I think that it's certainly true that you'll find articles about things that you'll say are not. Are not true, but I think that most of the reporting is terrifically honest and straightforward. And the you know, the actual news articles are really good, but which is not true of the Times. The Times is very politicized in its news reporting.
Mm-hmm.
No,
I wanted to ask you about Iraq. Iran. What's your take on the threats, the saber rattling that's going on with the United States?
Well. Nothing can happen because the U.S. military is completely over its head in Iraq. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that they can do to Iran.
There's no threat of mini nukes, what they call mini nukes?
No.
Okay.
I don't believe that. I think that, you know, that might be a fantasy of some neocons in the administration, but I think they're pretty well hamstrung on that. I mean, the world would erupt if that happened.
Yeah.
So I don't see it.
All right, and what do you write about when you're writing for Treasury and Risk Management magazine? I don't think I found any articles.
They're online. It's Treasury and Risk. I did a piece you might enjoy. It's a good magazine. I write for them because it's my bread and butter income. But they have a great editor, former Business Week editor, who. Really likes to do good issues, and just to give you an example, she just had me last year do a piece looking at how the big subsidiaries of American corporations operating in Canada, you know, like GM and Ford stuff, are major supporters of better funding for the Canadian National Health Plan, at the same time that in the U.S. they lobby against any state involvement in healthcare. And so I interviewed people from those companies to find out how come on one side of the border you have one perspective on national health and on the other side of the border you have a different view.
Mm-hmm. And what did they
That's
say?
That's a great story. Well, you know, they actually were arguing that it makes sense, but that it's just politically impossible to take that position in the U.S.
You can't support public health care?
Yeah, as a corporation.
Wow.
You know, it's just incredible. It's like totally ludicrous. It's cutting off their nose to spite their face because it makes sense for business to socialize the costs of health care.
Right.
But they just can't bring themselves to cross that ideological divide, you know. But that's an interesting story, which I could never have done in a non-business publication because the officials of the corporations would never have given me the time of day.
Mm-hmm.
But when you write for, I've found the same thing writing for Business Week. When you write for them, you get to talk to the CFOs and the CEOs, you know, and they tell you what they really think.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's an interesting magazine. You know, once in a while I write like total bullshit for them because they need a total bullshit story.
Mm-hmm.
It's harmless. You know, it's harmless, but it's just totally uninteresting.
Right.
But, I've written a lot for them about the crisis of healthcare costs for corporations, you know. And the obvious answer is socializing it, but, you know, meanwhile, they don't want to do that because it's not practical, so they're looking at what are the possible reforms for it, and they come up with all these ideas like, healthcare accounts, tax-free healthcare accounts, and all this stuff. So, you know, I end up writing about stuff like that, which I could really care less about, but they pay me $1.60 a word, so
wow,
I can't complain.
Yeah, bread and butter.
It subsidizes my other work.
And what are the most recent books that you've read that you've really kind of taken to?
Well, my reading has been focused on impeachment lately, so okay. You know, I was reading Risen. I read Risen's book, which is great, and Cy Hirsch's book, and you know, a lot of the Iraq stuff has been great. Next on my list is Greg Palast.
Armed Madhouse,
which, yeah, I haven't read yet. I got to read.
Yeah, that's supposed to be very good. They have him on Democracy Now! All the time.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
And what do you think about, he writes about the 2008 elections already being stolen. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I disagree with Greg on this, because...
And he actually also writes about there being a plan once Iraq got invaded. I mean, I remember that's something that you talked about in the interview, that you said that there was no plan, and that was grounds for impeachment, that there was, you know, a complete incompetence with, mm-hmm, with regard to not knowing what to do after they had, you know, supposedly won the war, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess those two things.
Yeah. No, I don't agree with everything that Palast comes up with, and one of the things I disagree with is the election theft story. I think he takes too far. I think there is election theft going on, and I think that there are, and I think it's happening not just with electronic voting. I think it's happening with old-style voting booths. But part of the problem is that you know, the parties are so dysfunctional, especially the Democratic Party is so dysfunctional, that people don't participate. And so when you start talking about elections being stolen the way Greg does, as a foregone conclusion, what it basically does is ensure that people won't bother to vote. And I'm more concerned with the fact that, for example, I can see it in my own area where I live, which is a slightly skewed Republican community, suburban community. And what you find is that Republicans volunteer for duty as official poll watchers and counters, right? Because that position is not in the individual election stations. It's done by, in most states this is true, it's done by appointees from the parties who go to the voting stations and man the booths and then count the votes.
It's true in Canada as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you don't have active party people enough to go to each voting station and do those jobs for the entire, every minute that the voting station is open, and especially at county time, you have no way to monitor what's being done. And what I've noticed is you can go at the end of the day, you can go during the day to vote and find no Democratic officials there. You can go at the end of the day when the count happens and there'll be no Democrats there. So who's monitoring the counting? You know, then it is really easy to steal, and it doesn't even have to be organized. I mean, all you need is a self-motivated, corrupt Republican who says, "Well, I'm going to kick this up by 100 votes," you know, and who's going to check?